Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo was censured Thursday by county commissioners over her behavior during a commissioner's court meeting. I'm Craig Cohen. Today on Houston Matters, what happened and why?
Houston Matters with Craig Cohen is a production of Houston Public Media with support from Baylor College of Medicine.
Also this hour, the latest on the ongoing quorum break in Austin. Then, from a zoo soliciting the public to donate animals to feed to some of its predators, to late Houston artist David Attuck's Beatles statues being relocated, this week's non-expert panel weighs in on the good, the bad, and the ugly of it all. Plus, 75 years ago today, the first Whataburger opened in Corpus Christi. We learn more about the history of the Texas fast food chain. We'll start with a news update from NPR and News 88.7. Stay with us. This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. Good morning. Coming up this hour, the latest on the quorum break, this week's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and we mark the 75th anniversary today of Whataburger. But first, Harris County Commissioners Thursday in a 3-1 vote censured Judge Lena Hidalgo, the chief executive of the county, admonishing her for her behavior at a commissioner's court meeting earlier in the day. Judge Hidalgo had been lobbying the commissioners to put a proposed tax hike to voters to pay for ARPA-funded early child care programs. That pandemic-era funding is due to expire next year. But it wasn't so much what she was lobbying for as how she was doing it. Here's just a sample. This is Commissioner Leslie Briones attempting to explain why she opposed the motion, which commissioners never actually voted on, only to be interrupted repeatedly by the county judge.
So these are federal dollars sent to the state, sent to the workforce board.
Not enough money.
They need to be optimized and scaled, and they are on first to set up a new program without a detailed
plan. We work with them to design
budget.
This.
Excuse me, please.
Falsehoods are not appropriate in front of children.
You should tell yourself that.
Commissioner Leslie Briones at the end there admonishing Judge Hidalgo. Houston Public Media's Sarah Gruno followed developments at Commissioner's Court Thursday and joins us now with more. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning.
It's not just all the interruptions, and there were plenty more than we heard there. Judge Hidalgo also brought children into the room. How come?
Yeah, several children who benefit from these early child care programs crowded the courtroom during the meeting. They also appeared in a press conference earlier in the day with Judge Hidalgo. And at different points during the meeting, she actually encouraged the children to come to the front of the courtroom in front of the dais and ask commissioners how they plan to vote on the proposed tax increase. At several points, there were chants that broke out during the discussion, and several commissioners called for order in the courtroom throughout the meeting.
All right. That aside for the moment, what exactly would this tax hike that the judge wants have paid for?
Yeah, Hidalgo's proposed tax rate increase would have covered three different child care programs. Early Reach provides daycare services for parents. County Connections is a summer camp program, and ACCTS provides education training for child care professionals. These programs were first funded, as you mentioned, by COVID-19 pandemic era dollars, which are set to run out by the end of the year. So in order for the tax hike to be placed on the November ballot, commissioners needed to have approved Hidalgo's motion by 12 p.m. yesterday, but she failed to get that support from her Democratic colleagues, like we heard. We heard a little that Commissioner Briones was trying to say...
And actually, since she started to kind of make her point, but because of those interruptions, maybe it wasn't clear what she was saying there. Can you explain the reason she did ultimately give for opposing the measure to bring this proposed tax increase to voters?
Yeah, we heard a lot of different things from commissioners. They never made an official vote on the tax increase proposal. Commissioners generally spoke in opposition. Commissioner Ramsey, for example, said when the child care programs began, there was an understanding that they would eventually end when COVID dollars run dry. And they also mentioned the county's major budget deficit as well.
And I guess I'll also point out Commissioner Briones had specifically noted that she didn't feel like there were proper details about how the money would be used, how much it would actually cost taxpayers, and also that there was research being done, a report that was going to come in the next year that would talk about how effective these programs were, and she was waiting for all of that. Harris County, in the meantime, is also facing a roughly $270 million budget deficit, which was exacerbated earlier this year by a pay increase to the tune of some $140 million for sheriffs and constables' deputies. When does the county budget process begin for fiscal year 2026?
Yeah, commissioners are already basically in the midst of discussions on the county's budget season. The next fiscal year begins in October. Commissioners have had some brief discussions about having to cut back on spending or raise taxes. So we're planning to hear more discussions on the county's budget deficit in future meetings.
So we could see more battles like this, potentially.
Yeah, that's right. There's definitely a lot of uncertainty right now still about how commissioners plan to address the major budget deficit. I know during a meeting in May, Hidalgo said that they will likely be forced to cut essential services for residents, like I mentioned, and they're already asking for additional cuts across different county departments as well.
After censuring Judge Hidalgo, did the county commissioners have anything further to say about yesterday's events?
Yeah, commissioners didn't have any follow-up conversations after they voted to censure Hidalgo yesterday. Ramsey originally made the motion for censure after the commissioners had voted on their decorum rules in court. And Commissioner Adrian Garcia also said that he had wished that they had taken the vote on decorum earlier in the day as well.
You were also in Austin yesterday. That's where Harris County Sheriff Ed Gonzalez appeared before a state commission to discuss the county's continued failure to meet the state's minimum standards for jail quality. What can you share us about that testimony?
Yeah, the jail commission members yesterday pressed Sheriff Gonzalez about the Harris County Jail's repeated failure to meet the state standards on jail quality. Again, we heard from Sheriff Gonzalez that the county is getting closer to stopping their process of outsourcing jail inmates. I will say that's something that we've heard several times over the past few months. Commission members also asked for a specific timeline on that, but it wasn't clear when that may actually stop. Several family members of people who have died in the Harris County Jail also appeared at the meeting to testify in front of the commission, and at one point were able to ask the sheriff several questions as well.
Houston Public Media's Sarah Gruno, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Speaking of Austin, it's day five now in which the Texas House of Representatives has failed to reach a quorum. More than 50 House Democrats remain out of state in an effort to stall a GOP plan to redraw district maps. The redraw is designed to help Republicans gain as many as five additional congressional seats in next year's midterms. Each day the Democrats remain out of Austin, they earn fines and also face added threats from Governor Abbott and other Republican officials. Texas Newsroom reporter Lucio Vasquez joins us now with the latest on that. Hi, Lucio.
Hi, how's it going?
Okay, so I guess the latest is U.S. Senator John Cornyn. He's facing a primary challenge from Attorney General Ken Paxton, but now Cornyn has waded into this fight. What's he been calling for?
Yeah, Senator John Cornyn has called for the federal assistance in locating and apprehending Texas House Democrats who fled the state in order to block the GOP-backed redistricting plan that you just mentioned. By doing so, Cornyn has essentially aligned himself with hardline efforts to pressure the absent lawmakers. You know, Governor Greg Abbott and AG Paxton has called for the arrest of these lawmakers as well. Notably, Cornyn says the FBI agreed to help, but we don't really know what the agency's involvement looks like exactly.
Has the FBI made any public statement about this?
No, they have not. The FBI has declined to comment publicly on the specifics of any ongoing investigation or involvement. As of now, like I said, it's pretty unclear as to what federal resources, if any, have been formally dictated or dedicated to tracking down the lawmakers.
This special session would end in a couple of weeks. Is it clear whether the House Democrats are likely to hold out until then to force the governor to call another special session?
You know, it's pretty unclear as of right now. I mean, most of the Democrats who've spoken publicly have said that they are intending to stay out of Texas, at least for the next few weeks until this current session ends. But Governor Greg Abbott has the authority to call as many special sessions as he'd like. So it's unclear as to how long they can potentially stay out of Texas.
Lucio Vasquez reports for the Texas Newsroom. Lucio, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And up next, a zoo wants animals it can feed to its predators. Maybe soliciting the public for their, quote, pets wasn't the best way to ask. We discuss on this week's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly as Houston Matters continues. A lot can happen in a week. Some of it good, some of it bad, some of it downright ugly. When faced with intriguing developments in the week's news, we turn to a rotating panel of non-experts to parse the good, the bad, and the ugly of it all. On today's panel, Houston Shakespeare Festival Artistic Director Jack Young, Houston Chronicle Senior Columnist Lisa Falkenberg, and David Branham, Professor of Political Science at UH Downtown. Jack, Lisa, David, welcome to Houston Matters.
Howdy, howdy.
Thank you, Craig.
Panel, the late artist David Attuck's beloved Beatles statues are on the move. Last weekend, the four statues of John, Paul, George, and Ringo were spotted being dismantled and removed from their temporary home at 8th Wonder Brewing in Edo. They'd been there since 2017. Turns out 6 months before the artist's death in July, he sold the statues to his longtime friend George de Montron III, the president and CEO of de Montron Auto Group. As Cron, Texas culture reporter Gwen Howerton explained this week, the auto dealer plans to install them at his Mazda of Clear Lake dealership along the Gulf Freeway in Webster, with plans to later show them off at other car dealerships he owns around town. The David Attuck's Beatles statues leave 8th Wonder Brewing bound for car dealerships. Is this good, bad, or ugly? David Branham, start us off.
Oh, this is really good. I mean, it's pretty amazing, actually. I know I'll be going to Webster to see them. This is a great commercial, too. I mean, it's better than putting yourself on TV over and over and again, saying, come to de Montron, buy your car. Now you can go just see the Beatles. And that's going to be great. I wonder now if there is anyone left in the world who doesn't like the Beatles. Because the people who didn't like the Beatles may all be gone. Like, my dad didn't really like the Beatles, but he's gone now. So,
all that shaggy hair.
Yeah, that horrible hair.
Get a haircut, you hippies.
So I'm gonna say this is fantastic. I think everybody's that is in my generation is going to love going to see those statues. I want to see all four of them. And then you're going to be able to use it as a history moment with your kids to be able to tell them, you know, these are the Beatles. I mean, they can hear the 60s music on the radio all the time, but they really get to see them. It's sort of their likeness, and talk about why they were so popular when they were going so strong. And the record is just absolutely amazing to me. So many number one hits in such a short time. It's just mind-blowing that they were able to hit the music scene like they did. No one has ever done it like that. So it's a nice history moment for anybody who goes to see them. It'll be a nice thing for people from in the baby boomer generation to talk about, you know, the Beatles, the impact they had, how they affected music and how they affected the social scene. So it's good all the way.
All right. Good, bad, or ugly, Jack Young.
I'll call it good. The fact that they're going to be moving around, I hope they don't get stuck in Clear Lake, that they do get to move around the way the Beatles did on the Walking Across Abbey Road. And, I mean, beyond the fact that it is the four Beatles, for those who know that it's the Beatles, they're fun statues. They're of a size. They catch your eye. The artist's work has always been of a size like, oh, wow, that's the big deal right off of 45. And so the fact that this commercial businessman is going to support that artist and move it around so that more people can share it, I think that's pretty cool.
Good, bad, or ugly, Lisa Falkenberg?
Oh, it's good. I don't know. I think that the Beatles would be better outside a Volkswagen dealership. I mean, you know.
They did start in Berlin.
That's true, but there's also the Beatles.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, okay, yes. Well, maybe Mr. De Montron will get another dealership.
Hmm. Well, this is his ticket to ride, and he don't care.
Oh, wow.
Well done.
This is
well
for you, done. Craig.
Hey, yes. He sells the Mazdas, cuckoo, cuckoo.
Isn't that a Carpenter song? Oh.
Yes, they redid it. Mm. And I have to say, I listen to the Beatles, and I'm like, oh, that's good. And then I listen to Karen Carpenter, and I'm like, no.
Not her
if
best.
I want to feel sad, you know, rainy days and Mondays aren't the only thing that get me down about her music. So, but no, I'm not one of these. I like the Beatles, but I'm not one of these people who just adores them, who totally gets it. So maybe I'm somehow on your list, David.
I'm not. No, you're not on my list.
I've been accused of like something is wrong with me that I don't just adore the Beatles. But I mean, obviously, you know, John Lennon, but I think that, this takes a little bit for me to get into the
kind of the early stuff. But no, this is great. I mean, this is much better than an inflatable gorilla or whatever it is that used car dealerships used to put outside the front to get attention. This is Houston, and some people might be bothered by the artistic next to the commercial. But that's what Houston is, right? Yeah. We got the Shakespeare Festival guide next to us. And, I mean, you're probably Chevron supporting your organization.
And that's been going on all along. I mean, there are all sorts of prints that we have from Maxfield Parrish that he did it for calendars that were for electric lights. The GE, early television, all was funded by different folks. That we wouldn't have the operas on PBS now if it weren't for Exxon. So that kind of corporate world, I mean, you know where the art is, that's where the money is.
I will also point out, while you may not be a huge Beatles fan, Lisa, my nephew Adam is. He is dramatically so. In fact, to the point, we went to see a concert when he was 12 years old. It was a Beatles tribute band. And afterwards, he's talking with the band members, and it was clear he knew more about the Beatles than they did. And he would be very angry with me if I didn't point out that, as a matter of fact, the Beatles were the ones who were first to record the song Ticket to Ride, and then the Carpenters depressed us all later.
Beautiful voice she had, yes, but you have to be in a certain mood to listen to it.
Yeah, for sure. There aren't many singers who the first adjective out of anybody's mouth is haunting. Like Karen Carpenter had a haunting voice. Yes. Speaking of haunting, panel, a zoo in northern Denmark needs your help. It's asking the public for donations. No, not money, animals. And no, not animals to stay in the zoo, or at least not to stay there long. See, the Aalborg Zoo says it has a responsibility to imitate the natural food chain of the animals in its care. That's why it is seeking small animals, even some horses, to feed to its captive predators. As CBS News and Agence France-Presse reported this week, the zoo in a social media post ensured that any chickens, rabbits, guinea pigs, or again horses that you might be willing to part with will be gently euthanized by trained staff before being fed. It's worth noting that post referred to the animals that it is seeking as pets. So yeah, in case you're wondering, the zoo then limited comments on that post after receiving responses the zoo termed hateful. Danish zoos seeking public donations of animals to feed to its captive predators. Is this good, bad, or ugly, Jack?
I'll call it good as we cue up Elton John singing The Circle of Life. We don't seem to have any trouble watching Simba and all those folks and marching around in animated things until it gets to the reel of, oh, wait, we're talking about Fluffy? So, and trying to explain to the young one that Fido went to the farm upstate is another whole deal. So when my daughter's handing her poor Oreo over to the vet and bidding farewell, well, who knows where Oreo went. Now she could probably still visit the animal at the zoo and go, well, part of that animal is carrying some of Oreo into the future.
In fact, it's still stuck in his teeth. Right. Look, there. You can see.
Wow.
It's a little more pragmatic and straight up than, you know, bending the truth to your young one to go, no, really, Fluffy's just gone on vacation. He'll come back someday.
That's dark. It's so dark. Good, bad, or ugly, Lisa?
I mean, I think that's the problem with the Danes, or that's the problem with people who are so cerebral and practical, and it makes sense in a way. It's good. It's kind of like giving your body to science, right? It's already dead. It's not like, here, take my little yapping puppy and put it in the jaws of this animal. But it's ugly, probably, the way they handled it, you know, the PR of it. I think about all of the dogs that are put down in this city, all the ones that are, you know, running around, breeding, you know, don't have enough to eat, biting people. I mean, there are a lot of animals that are put down, populations that have to be controlled. And, you know, could this be, you know, a use for them, perhaps? But I just think, yeah, I mean, these are not, give us your live animals. These are these animals will be put down and then they will be, you know, used for a good purpose. So the idea is fine, but we're not able to kind of accept it in our hearts, I guess.
I could volunteer some of the squirrels we have over here.
I agree. I was just about to say, don't they have any squirrels up there?
They like show up and go, hey, I know you've got something on you. Give me something. Like, okay, I know where you need to go. You need to go see Shasta down at the zoo.
Exactly. These squirrels are out of control.
Yeah.
They are aggressive.
Right.
In my hometown of Seguin, which is in the news every other week, but in the best barbecue in Texas. But in my hometown, there are squirrels that have started attacking people. Like, they will bite. If you don't have a hamburger, they are biting your leg.
Good, bad, or ugly, David Branham.
I like squirrels. It's, yeah, this is something. The reaction that I've seen to this is just amazing because it's so hypocritical, right? I'm putting meat in my mouth three times a day, mm-hmm. to, you know, eating animals myself. So the reality is that this shouldn't be so heart-wrenching. But I think I'm glad that Lisa says cerebral, because otherwise I was going to say something about Europeans that wasn't going to sound so nice, because this is like, no personality at all. It's just mechanical. Say, give me your animals so that I can feed them to my tigers and my bears. Give me your animals. You know, it's just not a good way to do it. Yeah, so you got hateful responses? You got hateful responses. So we're all hypocrites, out of sight, out of mind, right? I have a cat. I love the cat. My cat's staying in the house. It's not going anywhere. I love those little animals, and so I'll continue to do it, and I won't be thinking about it when I eat my meat that, you know, this is actually coming from a cow or a chicken. Mm-hmm. And so I'll go on with my life, you know, living in La La Land, being a hypocrite, and I'm going to say that this is bad because of that. They just should have handled it much better than they did. We all know in reality that this is something that happens, but we don't like to think about it or talk about it. And they made us do that. So it's bad.
Jack, is this really, even though a Danish thing, I'm thinking about Hamlet and how he would handle a situation like this.
Yes, we fed ourselves for them. We fed ourselves for maggots is what Hamlet's line is when he's up there at the gravesite looking around like, oh, we get around and there's York's skull. And like, okay, we do all this work and then we just turn into worm food. So all of us, every one of us is headed to one direction without enough formaldehyde mm-hmm. to keep you, you know, intact.
Well, and then wasn't there news somebody was buried in a mushroom casket this week? I think I saw it.
Oh, yes.
So there are ways
all
that people
ways.
Are doing it more yes. naturally. I mean, when I think of poor dear departed Sweet Tweet, it was our little bird that we had, parakeet. I'm not going to say how the bird died. But sitting in my previous address in the ground in a shoebox, with her favorite toy, doing no good to anybody.
Right.
You know? And this zoo is trying to find a way to, you know, Sweet Tweet would be more of an appetizer,
sure.
not a full meal.
We're composting, but, you know, so we, you know, compost the vegetables. We can find a way to repurpose Sweet Tweet.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet
yes.
Tweet.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, panel, voting is underway now for this year's Hambone Award. It's presented by Nationwide Pet Insurance. The award celebrates the most unusual pet insurance claim of the year. It's named for a dog who once got stuck in a refrigerator and ate a whole holiday ham while waiting to be discovered. This year's nominees include a dog who'd protected his human companion from a loose, angry bull, another who essentially OD'd on cicadas, ate too many of them, and one that swallowed a preserved dead alligator. Taxidermy, anyone? Anyone? The public vote continues through August 19th. A pet insurance company hands out an annual award for the weirdest claims it receives each year. Is this good, bad, or ugly, Lisa?
I'm trying to, I don't know, good, I guess. It's entertaining, certainly. But what is the point of this? You know, how does the
aside
company...
Aside from advertising
yeah,
for the pet insurance
how does the company
yeah.
benefit? Like, do they want more animals to be engaging? Is this setting a good example? You know, letting everybody know the crazy stuff these animals do. Maybe it's going to inspire more reckless behavior by some of the animals of their clients. Or is it, hey, animals do some crazy stuff. Yours might being locked in a refrigerator or eating a taxidermied alligator next week, and so you need to pay exorbitant prices for insurance?
Almost certainly. I think this is one of those cases where somebody was working there and just was passing around some fun anecdotes. Oh, you wouldn't believe what call I just got. And eventually someone came along and said, well, there's a way to market this.
The fact that there are 10 candidates to vote for.
Yeah.
Is this just in a calendar year? I mean, how long do they have to accumulate these wild?
This is an annual award.
Curious things.
Yeah.
Some of them were questionable. There was the one that might have maybe swallowed somebody's, what was it? iPhone or earbuds. And then it didn't really, but it still somehow made the list. Like, okay,
because they still tried to file for the claim for going to the vet.
It's like the 10 Oscar nominees. There are always one or two where you're like, really? Really? I saw that.
At least
2 hours
two,
I won't
yes.
get back, you know?
Yes.
Good, bad, or ugly, David?
I'm going to say good, just because I'm a market guy, and this is an ingenious way to advertise your insurance, get people to buy it. I never thought about buying insurance until I heard this, and now I've thought about it. And my answer is no, but at least I thought about it. So there are people out there who are actually thinking about it now and going, you know, my dog is crazy. My next door neighbor, he has two crazy dogs. One is really crazy, and he should buy this insurance. He needs it because, you know, it's not a good thing. So I would say this is good as far as, you know, advertisement. Getting people what they want. People are in the market for this insurance. Now they know, yeah, we can get this insurance. But and it's probably entertaining too. I agree that with Lisa that, you know, some of these things are just, you know, fun to look at. So I'll go with good on this.
All right. Good, bad, or ugly, Jack.
Does savvy count?
Sure.
I mean, it's not good, but it's
you can
savvy.
You can always do a fourth category.
Sure.
It's fine. Go off the board.
I grew up on a block. There were 26 kids under the age of 12, and we were running around the woods, and there were people had three or four dogs, and the idea of insuring
that's where I recognize you
Pepper,
from.
Sandlot.
The crazy dog that chewed its way through a garage door. I'm having a hard time getting that, and, you know, my brother bringing home the snake that we would then, like, insure the snake. No, I don't think we would be doing that, but mm-hmm. We're not in that time anymore, I suppose, and so folks do see them, these sentient four-legged things in their house as their fur babies, so they want to have coverage when they take their baby to the doctor. Okay, and for our friends at Nationwide to accumulate the 10 craziest things that could happen, and maybe Fido's next, is a savvy way of letting people know there's this thing out there. I don't know how often, do you get to vote multiple times?
I don't know. I don't think this is like the All-Star game for baseball, mm-hmm. where for some reason they let everybody vote 25 times.
Okay, well, you have to register and only vote once.
Yeah,
but
no,
you could get a whole group of people behind. A whole family could vote for their animal.
You get a campaign going. I think you should advertise for your favorite.
Okay, I mean, I could be a publicist for someone's animal that was looking to win the award, and then I could maybe...
There's got to be some soft money contribution you can do.
That could
come
in for the festival in a good way. Yeah,
okay. An issues ad that you can put out there that relates in some way. Jack Young is the artistic director of the Houston Shakespeare Festival. Lisa Falkenberg is a senior columnist with the Houston Chronicle. And David Branham is a professor of political science at UH Downtown. Jack, Lisa, David, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks, Greg.
Have a good weekend.
This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. Amid downtown Houston's many skyscrapers are a few buildings that really stand out among the rest. They may not necessarily be the tallest or the shiniest or even the first ones that you think of when you imagine the downtown Houston skyline, but there's something about them that makes them distinctive and both architecturally and historically important. To learn more about them, in 2018, Houston Matters' Joshua Zinn took us on a tour of some of downtown Houston's most historically significant skyscrapers.
The first stop on my journey downtown on a cool Friday morning was at the corner of Main Street and Preston Street, where I met up with Stephen Fox, a lecturer in architecture at both the University of Houston and Rice University. The plan was to look at six important buildings, starting with the 11-story Scanlon Building.
This was the tallest building constructed in Houston in the first decade of the 20th century. It was a steel frame skyscraper. This was, at least for Houston, a new technology. It was not the first steel frame skyscraper in Houston, but it was the tallest of the first decade.
The building is named after its developer, Kate Scanlon, who built it with her sisters on property that their father, T.H. Scanlon, owned. As for what the building actually looks like,
the Scanlon Building is faced with a kind of pearl-colored terracotta on the lower floors. It sort of looks like stone, and it was meant to look like stone. And then the upper floors are clad in a glazed white brick. So the building sort of really sparkles when the reflected light hits it, as it does this morning.
And if you're looking at it from across the street, it looks like a simple rectangle-shaped building. But as Stephen Fox explained, it has a very specific shape because of Houston's climate.
It appears to be a simple rectangular shape. It's a little bit more complex than that. It's actually an L-plan building. So if you can imagine kind of the letter L laid on the ground, the two long faces line the street sides of the property, but the inner corner is sort of hollowed out. And that was done so that although the building did have electric lighting, it was sort of low intensity lighting, and it was before the invention of air conditioning. So buildings had to be designed to work in this hot, humid climate. And therefore they had relatively thin floor plates and often were organized in this kind of alphabet arrangement, either the letter L, the letter U, the letter H, the letter E, in order to have these light and air courts that cut into the building.
From there, we moved down Main Street towards Texas Street in our next target. Along the way, Stephen pointed out another part of the city's architectural history.
Canopies like this were once very common in downtown Houston, so the Wise Hotel canopy is one of the few that's left.
Uh-huh. Keep people in the shade and, yes, and keep them cool.
Yes, and out of the rain.
Right.
Then we arrived at the J.P. Morgan Chase Building, or as it's historically known.
We're now in front of the Gulf Building. The Gulf Building is Houston's great Art Deco skyscraper. It was built by Jesse H. Jones, someone who was a formidable entrepreneur who, during the 1930s, entered public life and became really the financial savior of the United States during the Great Depression, working within the New Deal administration of President Franklin D. Roosevelt. The building is a very, very kind of sophisticated work of urban architecture. There is a five-story limestone base that has a kind of diagonal corner at the street corner of Main Street and Rusk Avenue, where it is located. And then the office tower rises from atop that. At the very top, the building begins to set back, and that was sort of a kind of architectural innovation for 1920s American skyscrapers. Basically, the buildings had this kind of telescoping profile, so that as they rose, they also kind of receded in terms of their shape. When it was completed in 1929, the 36-story building was the tallest in Houston, and because of the outbreak of the Great Depression, it remained the tallest building in Houston until 1963.
The Gulf Building formerly belonged to Texas Commerce Bank and is now owned by J.P. Morgan Chase, hence its newer name. Continuing our journey along Rusk and taking a left at Travis Street, we found ourselves in front of the Niels Espersen Building.
The Niels Espersen Building was completed in 1927. It was at 32 stories. It was the tallest building in Houston when completed, although 2 years later the Gulf Building was completed and sort of overshadowed it. Like the Scanlon Building, the Niels Espersen Building was also built by a woman developer, Mellie Keenan Espersen. She erected the building as a memorial to her husband, Niels Espersen, an oil man, who had intended to build a tall office building, but who died just after the initial planning began.
And for me, the architectural elements of this building stand out pretty starkly compared to the previous two.
Architecturally, the Niels Espersen Building is detailed with monumental classical architecture. The entry is in a recessed loggia that kind of steps back from the sidewalks and is framed by two giant Corinthian columns, sort of fluted columns on tall bases. There are Roman bucrania, which is sort of the Latin term for these ornamental skulls, a kind of classical Texan architectural ornament. So the building is kind of very rich in this florid Italian Renaissance detail. And again, the Renaissance being one of the historical phases of classical architecture. The building was a setback skyscraper. Again, it had that tiered telescoping profile. And atop it, which you can just barely see from where we're standing, is a circular tempietto, a classical temple form that was associated in classical architecture with sort of memorial practices. So it was the architect Eberson's way of announcing that this building was meant to serve as the memorial to Niels Espersen.
From there, we went a few blocks east to the quite modern-looking Tenneco Building, now known as the Kinder Morgan Building, designed by Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, and finished in 1963. As Stephen Fox explains, the modern architecture emphasizes the functional parts of the building's structure.
So the architecture really comprises the steel columns that support the building, the steel beams that span between the columns at each floor level, then a glass curtain wall. So rather than embedding the supporting steel structure within a brick or stone exterior facing, the steel structure is allowed to kind of become the architecture, and the walls themselves disappear and become these completely transparent glass planes. So in that way, the structural frame shades the glass because it is inset rather than being right in the same plane with the structural frame. So it seemed to be to meet both the kind of ethical expectations of modern architecture, but also recognize that building in Houston in this kind of hot, sunny climate requires a different response than if you were at a more northern latitude.
And the part of the building that stands out the most is the base, which was changed with new ownership.
When Kinder Morgan bought this building, they completely reconfigured the central elevator core and also the base of the building. And they replaced the original banking hall that was at the base of the building with a new multi-level interior lobby, which was set within this kind of cylindrical glass curtain wall.
Our next stop was just across the street.
We're standing looking at One Shell Plaza on Louisiana Street and McKinney Avenue. It's diagonally across the intersection from the Tenneco Building. One Shell Plaza was the first building in downtown Houston built by the developer Gerald D. Hines. When it was completed in 1971, the 50-story building was the tallest in Houston. It is a work of distinctive architecture, but also very distinctive engineering. The designing architect Bruce Graham and Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill's engineer Fosler Kahn worked together to develop Kahn's idea of the framed concrete tube, which was a particular structural system that enabled Gerald Hines to build this 50-story building for approximately the same amount of money that Tenneco had spent on the 33-story Tenneco building across the street. You may notice that the building... Well,
at that point, a truck had parked right in front of us, blocking our view of the building. So we had to restart. Okay.
As this tall building, which consists of just a grid of rectangular windows, begins to descend toward the ground, the rectangular exterior walls actually begin to ripple as though it were almost a fabric. And what that expresses is the distribution of gravity loads in the building at the kind of two points on each side of the building. And the building becomes sort of thicker at those points, producing that sort of rippling profile.
Beyond the design of the building itself, its placement in downtown also stood out to Stephen Fox.
Another interesting decision made by Gerald Hines was siding this building, moving it off Main Street, the kind of traditional central corridor of downtown Houston and positioning it so that the sort of people who had offices downtown who got to make decisions about where to lease space for their offices could see it as they were driving into town on Allen Parkway or Memorial Drive. So it is really the kind of centerpiece of the skyline of downtown when seen from the west.
Our final stop took us to Jones Plaza on Louisiana Street.
Well, we're looking at Pennzoil Place. Pennzoil Place is on Louisiana Street and Capitol Avenue downtown. It was built by Gerald D. Hines and designed by the New York architects Philip Johnson and John Burgee, along with S.I. Morris Associates of Houston. Pennzoil Place is the most architecturally, historically significant building in downtown Houston because it changed the course of skyscraper design in the 20th century. And it really grew out of some of the limitations of the project. One of the kind of problems they presented to Philip Johnson and John Burgee was to design a building that would have two distinct identities. During their kind of analysis, they thought that maybe a 72-story building, which in 1970, when they began this project, would have been 20 stories taller than One Shell Plaza, which had just been completed. So very ambitious.
So instead of the one big tower, they split this building into two shorter trapezoid-shaped towers, very different from the blockier buildings we visited before.
And by having the towers be reflexively symmetrical, which is a kind of mirror the shape of the other, Johnson was able to get these two towers sort of onto a single Houston City block, which is not that big, and then provide between them this pair of triangular plazas organized not around the outside of the building, but really on the inside, sort of separating the two towers, which are only 10 feet apart. So they have this kind of narrow slot between the two towers. When it was completed, it was really hailed both nationally and globally as charting this new course in skyscraper design in which a kind of spectacular imagery outweighed the kind of economic functionalism of earlier modern buildings. So today, that kind of trajectory, that search for kind of spectacular shapes prevails very, very strongly in 21st century high-rise design. And this is the building complex that it all came from.
Six skyscrapers certainly doesn't cover all that downtown's skyline has to offer, but these six landmark buildings paved the way for the bigger and taller ones that stand out from a distance. And I might have to make another trip downtown in the future to learn more about those. For Houston Matters, I'm Joshua Zinn.
Joshua Zinn and architecture professor Stephen Fox took that tour of downtown Houston skyscrapers back in 2018. One of the buildings they visited, the Scanlon Building, is preparing for a transformation of sorts. Early next year, Sugarland-based SLTX Capital plans to start remodeling it to turn it into a 140-room Canopy by Hilton, tentatively slated to open in the summer of 2027. Still to come, we mark the 75th anniversary of a true Texas staple, Whataburger. Stay with us as Houston Matters continues. Seventy-five years ago today, the first Whataburger opened in Corpus Christi. Today, the orange and white striped fast food chain is more than a Texas staple. It's shorthand in popular culture for the region it hails from. It's seen by many here as a uniquely Texan phenomenon. In fact, a lawmaker on the floor of the Texas House once declared it a state treasure. Donna Tuttle is Whataburger's Vice President of Marketing and Communication. She tells Houston Matters' Brenda Valdivia about the chain's history.
Whataburger, Whataburger, just Whataburger should be.
In 1950, Harmon Dobson, who was an entrepreneur, wanted to build a burger so big it took two hands to hold. And when people bit into it, they'd say, Whataburger. And so that's, you know, how Whataburger got its start and its name, and that was in Corpus Christi. And, you know, he was a pilot, and as he began building the restaurants, he wanted to be able to see them from the air. And that's why the orange and white stripes, how they came about. He wanted to be able to see the buildings while he was flying over them. I mean, those orange and white stripes are still iconic today. Like, people see orange and white and they think Whataburger. So yeah, that's the origins.
And what was Harmon like as a person?
by all accounts. And his wife, Grace, took over the business, by the way. She has three small children, so little woman power moment there. But by all accounts, you know, we are a family-driven business. Their family's values of kindness and commitment to community and giving back continue today. They're just good people who really felt like they had and were building this great business, and it was important to them to give back to the community. And we have, like, I carry in my badge, there are some guiding principles that Grace Dobson put in place when she took over. And we all use those guiding principles still today in everything that we do.
Whataburger has such an iconic look. You know, back in the day, they had those almost triangle-shaped roofs, obviously very easy to see if you are a pilot. You know, it makes sense. Is that part of the way that Whataburger stood out in Texas, not just for folks flying above, but as a way to stand out from its competition?
Absolutely. I mean, the branding for this brand is so strong, you know, and I think Harmon had that eye for what makes things stand out, right? The 5-inch burger when everybody else was selling 4-inch burgers, things like the orange and white striped A-frame, we call that architecture the A-frame. You know, it did make us stand out from competitors. You'll see that we're starting to work those stripes back into some of our newer restaurants today to keep that legacy going.
Now, 75 years is a long time. And when Whataburger first started, the fast food industry was nascent. Like, nobody really knew what to make of drive-thrus and walk-ups. It was even question marks about how this could work. What were those first 10 years for Whataburger like?
Well, you know, again, I have to rely on some history here, since obviously I wasn't there. But, you know, I think it grew rapidly. You know, we expanded out into Florida by 1959, I believe, give or take. And we started franchising early. And so those first 10 years, the growth was rapid. I think, you know, when you look at McDonald's and Burger King and Whataburger, you know, people were just starting to think about eating outside the home at a place that wasn't a sit down, you know, full service restaurant. And so I think, you know, had great popularity at the time. And, you know, to go back to those orange and white stripes, there was no internet back then. There were no cell phones. You know, today people text each other where they're going and they meet up. Well, you know, the high school kids had to have a landmark where they were going to meet because they couldn't call each other. And so, you know, Whataburger became that place. And I think, well, I know part of the reason why Whataburger is so beloved in Texas is because that's where everybody ended up after school, after the games. And then that got passed down from generation to generation. I can't tell you how many people stopped me in the airport, you know, and anybody that's wearing a Whataburger shirt to tell their Whataburger story. And it usually starts something like, my grandfather used to take me to Whataburger on Saturdays. I was helping him build a fence. And when we finished building the fence, my treat was to go to Whataburger. And so this gentleman who told me this story said he now does that with his son. And so those stories are just, you know, they're really heartwarming to that they have let a brand in to part of their most personal moments of their life.
Now, there is oftentimes when you talk about Whataburger, especially online, you'll end up hearing about In-N-Out. There's this regional rivalry. What does this mean to both your brands, and what's pushing that forward?
So I think people love rivalries, right? And if you think about In-N-Out, started in California, so California's extremely proud of their In-N-Out burger. Whataburger started in Texas, and so Texans are very proud of their Whataburger. And I think, you know, people love to fuel the flames of, you know, that rivalry. It's like a high school rivalry almost. And we welcome it. I mean, how much fun to have, you know, being part of anybody's discourse, but especially on social media, all the fans deciding who's better, In-N-Out or Whataburger. It's all in good fun. You know, I think some people take it quite seriously. obviously we think Whataburger is the better burger, but we enjoy, you know, to stay alive in any industry, you have to have competitors. And so our employees and their employees and others in the industry, we go to the same conferences together. We know some of our peers. And so it's in good fun as well.
That's what we call getting out Whataburgered.
What a burger.
Just like you like it.
Donna Tuttle is Vice President of Marketing and Communication for Whataburger. She spoke with Houston Matters producer Brenda Valdivia. The fast food chain's first restaurant opened in Corpus Christi 75 years ago today. And that will do it for today's show. The Houston Matters team includes Michael Haggerty, Joshua Zinn, Brenda Valdivia, Mincho Jacob, and Laura Walker. Jared Carroll's our technical director. On Monday's show, Joshua Zinn will step in for me, and he'll talk with the head of Harris Health, Dr. Esmael Porsa, who makes his case for expanding Bentaub Hospital, which would include seizing 9 acres of largely unused land from Herman Park. Also, we'll welcome your gardening questions from Meg Tapp from the Garden Club of Houston. I'm Craig Cohen. Have a great weekend, and join Josh on Monday for those and other Houston Matters.